This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The U.S. Supreme Court concluded its term Thursday with a barrage of significant rulings. The justice had lifted speech restrictions on state court judges campaigning for election. They approved random drug tests for high school students who participate in extracurricular activities. And the court upheld a school voucher program in Cleveland, Ohio, that provides public money for parents to pay tuition at religious schools. Dan Shore joins us now. Good morning, Dan.
Morning, Scott.
And this decision on school vouchers has long been anticipated. Why is the ruling seen as so significant?
Well, I think it's a part of the ideological contest that has made such a battleground of our schools. I think it's also another evidence of the enormous amount of energy that this nation seems to be willing to invest in defining the relationship between church and state. You know, this is a 5-4 decision, and it's far from the end of the battle. What it tends to do is simply to shift the battle into the political arena, to the state capitals, ultimately into election campaigns.
I know you've been looking into this. The court, in its majority ruling, relied on the fact that the government is providing money in the form of a voucher to parents to make what the court called a true private choice.
Mm-hmm.
What are the range of choices that parents have in Cleveland, for example?
You mean, how free is the choice, really? Well, you take the Cleveland plan, the voucher payment per child is capped at $2,250. Mm-hmm. That may be enough for tuition in a subsidized parochial school. It is not enough, by far as I happen to know myself, to pay for secular private schools, which cost a lot more. And so it's 95% of the voucher money in Cleveland has gone to parochial schools. Is that really then free choice? Then if the voucher idea catches on, which it hasn't very much yet, but if it catches on, then the net effect is that money shifts from the public schools. How free then is the choice of parents who are left with children in underfunded public schools?
Let me raise this question. A story almost happened this week in that two or three judges in an appellate court in San Francisco held it's unconstitutional to require public school students there to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. They thought specifically the phrase "under God" constituted state mandate of religion. Decision's been stayed, but politicians of all stripes had something to say on this.
Yeah, well, I don't think the decision is going to last very long. I mean, either it'll go en banc, that is, to the full Ninth Circuit Court, and or to the Supreme Court. And given the way the Supreme Court's been acting, I cannot conceive that this decision would survive very long. I'll tell you, if that Ninth Court decision didn't do anything else, what it did do was to give us a very heartwarming Independence Day rally around the flag by everybody in Congress. After all the trouble we're having getting legislation through and getting them to vote on anything really important, like drug benefits for Medicare patients, for once you get Congress speaking with a heartwarming single voice and very, very loudly. And maybe somebody should thank Judge Goodwin in the Ninth Circuit Court for having provoked that. I'll tell you, Scott, what are you supposed to think about a country where you can't sneeze without somebody invoking God's blessing? You know, the Germans say Gesundheit, the Russians say Nazdarovia, your health. The British will say bless you, but without God in it. But we have to bring God into every act. God bless you, right? And you may take this as a segue into what I think will may be our next subject.
Mm-hmm.
Where was God when the God-fearing executives at Enron and WorldCom and Xerox were defrauding their investors and employees?
All right, it is, okay, you've assured it. It is our next subject. WorldCom, we learned this week, seems to have improperly reported nearly $4 billion in expenses. Xerox has now announced that it incorrectly stated $6 billion in revenues almost 5 years. In addition to obviously criminal investigations that will now proceed, what does this mean for the U.S. economy? We're several billion dollars off, aren't
we? Well, we're several billion. It does not take a great financial wizard, which I am not one of, to know that it is very bad for the economy when investors lose confidence in the word of their corporate leaders, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I can remember way back to the Eisenhower administration when we had a business leader, Charlie Wilson of General Motors, became Secretary of Defense, and he said what's good for General Motors is good for America, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people accepted it at that time. Can you imagine today that Army Secretary Tom White, who comes from Enron, could say what's good for Enron is good for America? Can you imagine anybody today being able to say that? So you ask about the economy, but the effects are not just on the economy. You know, past week, our president was up in Western Canada for the summit of the G8 used to be the G7, but now Russia's a member, so it's now the G8. And you'd think, you know, that they'd be talking about very important matters there. How does Mr. Bush look as he tries to project to the foreign countries, as he likes to do, that the United States is not only the most powerful nation on the earth, but it's the most moral nation on earth? He defines the world between good guys and bad guys, being good and evil. And so up in Canada, he's on television saying that he's now ordering the Justice Department to prosecute corporate lying, which you do not think you would require an order from the president. But there you are. So you ask, is it good for the America? It is not good for America's standing in the world that this great capitalist nation has managed to convey the impression that you can't trust our great capitalists.
Let's turn to events in the Middle East. President Bush gave a long-awaited speech on Monday. It had been tipped that he might call for an interim Palestinian state, whatever that means. Instead, he made a very explicit statement calling for a change in Palestinian leadership. Why do you think this change was made?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, last weekend, even as the final touches were being put on the speech that the president was going to make, Israel came up with some evidence that Yasser Arafat had authorized a $20,000 payment to the organizers of a suicide bombing in Jerusalem, and that was it as far as Arafat was concerned. So now we have the Bush position, which is we still want to see a Palestinian state, but surely we can't talk about it now until we have a Palestinian Authority, which is anti-terror and not corrupt and democratic, to be able to talk to. So what is the net effect of that? It enables the president to tell all the Arab states that he still wants a Palestinian state, and he's all for it, yes, but he doesn't have to do anything about it now, or at least for the conceivable future, until you get the kind of Palestinian authority that one can talk to. All of this makes his political advisors and Prime Minister Sharon very, very happy.
Let me ask a more practical question, though. By the way, President Bush seemed to specifically avoid referring to Yasser Arafat by name.
He didn't have to.
Everybody knows Yasser Arafat. Palestinian Authority has called for elections to take place next January. People on the ground there say, at least for the moment, it is inconceivable that Yasser Arafat won't win those elections.
Right.
Where does that leave U.S. policy?
That leaves the president with some very creative work to do by his speechwriters in order to be able to explain that most of the time this country favors accepting the result of any free election, most of the time. Every now and then a problem arises. I'm not quite sure how they'll solve it, but hey, that will not be until next year sometime.
Oh, all right. So there are elections to get through first. Is there a different long-term strategy that seems to be emerging on the Middle East? That's something that the president talked about in Canada.
There is a background strategy that they want to talk about when they feel they can talk about it, which is to establish some kind of an interim state somewhere between where we now are and where a Palestinian state would be. They keep referring to interim or provisional and so on, and then they say, yes, we have this great, great idea, and one of these days we're going to tell you about it, but we can't tell you about it until we have some decent people there to talk to.
Thanks, Dan Shore.